good times. Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz. I got my Chuck Schirmer specials on, ready to present. It's all nose. It's all... Yeah. Does that mean anything to anybody? If you listen to the show, you'll know.
Chuck Schumer special.
Chuck Schumer specials.
Sounds like a sex move is what it sounds like.
Oh, no, no, no. I was thinking more along the lines of my glasses, Adam. But anyway. Wow, that was a fail. Okay. So.
Okay.
What's happening?
Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading Open Sources on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today, the carbon tax is killing us. Why is the carbon tax killing us, guys? Just kidding. We'll talk about the latest regarding the politics of the carbon tax, which went into effect last week, rather harmlessly. We'll see. Then electoral reform was not enthusiastically endorsed in BC just before the Christmas break. So where does the battle go from here? And then lastly, we will hear Scotty's interview with John Smith, son of the world's oldest rebel, Harry Leslie Smith, who sadly passed away back in November. John Smith was in town last week, making a personal appearance at the Breezy Corners breakfast meeting. That is held by counselors Phil Alt and James Gordon at the Breezy Corners there every Thursday morning. But first, the U.S. government shutdown, which this time tomorrow will be tied for the longest in U.S. history. And by this time on Saturday, it will be the longest in U.S. history. So today was part two of the Trump quote-unquote charm offensive to try and sell this idea of a border wall. He did part one on Tuesday night, making a speech from the Oval Office, which was really a remix of his greatest hits. It was kind of a mega mix of racism and lies and fantasy. And then today he went to the U.S. border. He's in a town, Hidalgo, Texas, which is actually one of the safest communities in the country. But it's right there on the border. So Trump went there to, you know, sort of see what was going on. But the interesting thing about all this is that Trump was apparently telling people off the record on Tuesday that he didn't want to do any of it.
Like, at all?
Or? At all. That, yeah.
Oh, he didn't want to go do the
speech and then go to, yeah, go to the border.
And I didn't catch too much of what he was doing today, but it was mostly show and tell. I saw pictures like, here's the gun we got, and here's drugs that were in a fire extinguisher, or did you see this part where it's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not a lot of, there's not going to be a lot of deep policy.
Yeah, and a bag of money labeled $300,000 or something. It's like the old cartoons where it had a dollar sign on it.
Had a dollar sign.
And you knew that those thieves were up to no good. So,
and then Ivanka Trump walked by, and then a wolf howled and banged his fist on the table.
She said, I don't care. Do you?
Yeah.
whatever the heck
Take
it was.
Take that, Melania Trump, wherever you are.
Yeah. I guess we're being unfair to Melania a little bit. It's not her fault, or maybe it is. So the crisis, God, the immigration crisis has caused, caused all of this, right? Wrong. In my opinion, in our opinion, I would believe. So we've still got 800,000 people off work in the U.S. And now Trump, something he was saying on Tuesday, and actually not on Tuesday, it would have been yesterday. Okay, let's start with the speech. Did you watch the speech on Tuesday?
I caught the highlights.
Is that, if I got it right, that's the first one that he did from the Oval Office?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he didn't stick around, right? It's just kind of like, not stick around. Sorry, I'm confusing Tuesday and Wednesday. So much happening on this, right? So,
Wednesday was a meeting with congressional leaders.
Where he ran away.
Where he went in. And gave out some candy, and Mike Pence thought that was like the best thing ever for some reason.
That is the most I've, that's what I was getting to. That's the most I've ever heard Mike Pence speak ever. I was like, wow, it's Pence. He's coming to the mics. What's happening? Because I was watching it live, whatever it was, NBC. And he gave his little spiel about the meeting, or the failed meeting, I suppose.
Well, it was...
Because Trump said in the speech on Tuesday, he's like, well, we can solve this in 45 minutes. And then the meeting was 15 minutes.
If they came to the table and basically did what he wanted. Now, according to Trump, it didn't go down like this. He said that this morning, that the fake news reported it wrong. But he said the report from Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, mm-hmm. and Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, was that they came in with candy. Everyone settled down. Trump said, hey, you want to end this today? Just, you know, I'll build my wall. And Nancy Pelosi was like, no thanks. And Trump's like, well, if you're not going to take me seriously, I'm leaving. And then turned around on his heels and walked in the door. He may have pounded on the table, may have not. But by all accounts, the great negotiator just bailed.
And what it seems his exact words were, quote, bye-bye.
At least that's what everybody agrees on, that he said bye-bye. Yeah, even he admitted he said bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Like,
you can hear him saying it.
Like that David Spade sketch from Saturday Night Live in like 1991. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, bye-bye. Yeah, it's bizarre because there was also reporting over the weekend that the wall, the great big beautiful concrete wall, was originally a pneumatic device created by Roger Stone and other campaign advisors so that he would stay on point on immigration, because the president of the United States of America is so ignorant and has such a short attention span that they had to create a way for him to stay on his own political message, and that was the wall. And lo and behold, it worked. So just to frame what's going on in the United States right now, you have a president the majority of the of people didn't vote for, closing the government that the majority of people don't want, closing or in order for an idea that the majority of the people don't want, that was just a fantasy to get him to stay on topic to begin with, a metaphor, just like Lindsey Graham said. Although Lindsey Graham thought there was something behind the metaphor, it turns out sometimes a metaphor is just a metaphor.
Yeah, because Trump is here. That's like that whole they tell you when you're talking to a group of people, just focus on a point at the back of the room that isn't really any one person. That's what this sounds like. But the problem with Trump is, when he locks on to an idea, he doesn't let go. If he just, if I understand it right, he gets it in his head that this is how it has to be and it has to be his way, and he doesn't let go unless it seems like he has won or gotten a good deal. So, which this probably isn't going to happen in this situation. It looks like the House is passing measures to progressively open various parts of the government. I guess this is how it works. It's shut down, but they can say, okay, but we want to open this, this, and this.
Right.
And it's voted on. And it would seem if that keeps up and say the Senate backs down on it, then, or if the Senate, even the Senate passes it, the president could veto any number of these measures. And then there's, you know, the veto override. This could potentially just go on and on and on. And with Trump saying too, well, we're going to keep it closed for a long, long time. What's weird about it too is that well, I mean, he always kind of changes his story, but today or late last night, he was talking about the terrific patriots who are the workers who are currently not getting paid. There's a ton of people not getting paid. The essential people have to keep working. They're not getting paid. There's what they're calling the furlough people who are just kind of sidelined. They're not essential, but they're not working. And then there's a whole ton of contract people who are just cut loose, essentially, until this gets resolved, as I said earlier, to the tune of 800,000 people.
And there are also contractors who will not even get back pay.
Yes. And and there's like contractors for contractors. Like it's all the ancillary spinoff stuff.
Right.
Everything from like the restaurant that feeds these people, that kind of stuff.
Like the cafeteria people, the janitorial
people.
Staff. So we're not talking about like defense contractors. Like Lockheed Martin is going to be fine.
They'll be okay.
We're talking about like the people who are the actual machinery of these places.
The grunts.
The grunts.
Pick up the garbage at the Washington Monument, which seems to be overflowing. That's always the shot they show. The Washington Monument and garbage. He said he's heard from so many of them, which I think is probably about 7 or 8, who are terrific patriots, and they're with him all the way. You know, out of 800,000, there's going to be somebody that's supporting Trump, but it also sounds like the grumbling is that Republicans may be caving as well. He's pretty much saying that everybody's on side with this, but it sounds like in the House, there's certain Republicans is like, I guess if it affects something in their riding, say there's like, I don't know, a big national park or something that's also...
Well, there are a lot of... one of the senators we're talking about is Lisa Murkowski, one of the senators from Alaska. And of course, there's a lot of federal employees in Alaska. It's, it's a northern state where there's a lot of government services that have to be provided. And so there's also Susan Collins, who from Maine. Susan Collins is literally the last Republican politician in the northeastern
New England, United States. In there, yeah.
At least on a national level, everyone else is a Democrat. So if she has any designs on running for re-election, she's in trouble. And the other one was Cory Gardner, who's from Colorado, purple state, was just sworn in the first openly gay man to be governor in California. So he knows he's in trouble too. So Trump is an anchor on all these people right now. That's why we haven't heard much from Mitchell McConnell.
Mitch McConnell. How's he doing? I haven't heard a thing.
Yeah, I know, right? He's hiding in a shell. But no, he. You pointed this out that he could end this tomorrow, by having a vote in the Senate. He passed a bill before the break, a continuing resolution, which would just keep the government open for another couple of months, 100-0. If you don't know your math very well, 100 is a bigger number than 67, which is the threshold to override a veto.
Two thirds.
So it can be done. He won't do it, and admittedly, he's caught between a rock and a hard place because Mitch McConnell is not well liked himself, even in his own backyard in Kentucky. And at the same time, he's facing. You know, he knows what's right. He knows that the wall is stupid, that it's imaginary, that it's not going to solve anything, that it's a ridiculous waste of time, effort, and energy, let alone the message it sends. But he's caught. And I think the question is, as this goes on, for a lot of these Republicans who know better and should know better, but don't seem to be acting like they know better, is you're going to be able to save yourself. You're going to be able to save your party. Or you're going to be able to save your country. You can't do all three. Either you put up and recognize that maybe you're going to be primaried from the right by someone who's going to be more Trump, more pro-Trump than you pretend to be, or you let the country sort of flounder. And I heard somebody make this point today. Last week, China put a probe on the other side of the moon.
Yeah, the dark side.
Well, that's an anachronism. Thanks, Pink Floyd.
Floyd fans will always have a dark side. Yes, the opposing side that does not face the
moon
the Earth
spins.
Side of the moon.
There's always a dark side. There's not one singular dark side. Having said that, China is coming along. This was already going to be China's century to begin with. And how does it look when China's putting stuff on the moon and the United States can't even be open for business? And then on top of it all, Donald Trump comes out and says, you know what, I think I have an easier time negotiating with China than I do with the Democrats. And it's like, well, what does that say about you, master negotiator? Because all we've seen from you in negotiating with China is you talking about what a great relationship you have with President Xi. President Xi and I have a great relationship. Ugh.
Loves the strong men.
Yeah.
Especially the one from China. And this is part of it, too, is that he keeps referring to the wall as my wall. And I think this is the big issue that it's, like I said earlier, when he locks onto it. But just before airtime, I saw, and I'm not sure, I don't think it's fake news, because I thought this when they were talking about the steel barrier as opposed to the concrete wall, that a really decent chop saw could probably saw through it. And somebody said, oh, here's a sample of the wall. And then we just did
I saw
this,
that.
And we chopped through, and then people can go through.
Yeah.
So, you know. Is the steel barrier going to cut it? Probably not.
The thing is, though, that he's framing it like he's doing the country a favor because, you know, we're going to bring back steel at the same time, big, beautiful U.S. steel, and we're going to build a fence. Mm-hmm. And he thinks
Mexico
that's a compromise, too. It's not a concrete wall anymore. It's a steel fence. There. We move to the left for you.
Oh, yeah. He's Stalin now. I completely forgot what I was going to say. Oh, yeah, he was. Yeah, he's not Stalin now. I shouldn't say that. What he's saying about Mexico paying, but he's like, of course Mexico will pay, but they will pay. He did some sort of spiel about, yeah, they're going to pay, but they're paying with the free trade agreement. And I was like, and honestly, this was this afternoon. I'm like, what the hell is he talking about?
Yeah.
Mexico's going to pay, but they're not going to pay. But do you mean like pay is like the wall is metaphoric and Mexico paying is metaphoric? They're going to pay, but they're going to pay in as in you'll pay.
Right. He said today, he's like, I never said Mexico was going to pay for it, like,
with
a check.
He said it over and over again.
He said it over again. And there was like
the talking point.
His first week in office, he called Peña Nieto and was begging. He was begging Peña Nieto, just say you're going to pay for the water so I can stay face. Just say it. Just go out and say it. And Peña Nieto's like, I'm not going to do that.
I'll say it or I'm going to flush.
Yeah. He's like, I'm not going to do that. So, this was always a stupid idea. I saw Katie Tur talk about how she was talking to people on the campaign trail, and even people who went to Trump rallies and took part in like the call and response, like who's going to pay for the wall in Mexico?
Mexico.
A lot of those people thought it was a metaphor. So what are we even talking about? And the kicker is, Donald Trump famously hates to lose, and unless he's going to enact emergency powers,
which he has threatened to.
He's going to lose because absolutely nobody wants this. Even the people who say that they want it, nobody wants it.
So hopefully the shutdown will come to an end sooner rather than later. But I think we're probably, if not next week, then the one after, probably still be talking about this.
Probably.
Ay, ay, ay.
Okay. Let's talk about
something a bit more calm.
Political stuff close to home. The carbon tax. So that went into effect here in Ontario and in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and New Brunswick last week. The four provinces that did not come up with a carbon a way to address the $20 per ton price that the federal government wanted to put on carbon. So it has been imposed upon us and Manitoba and Saskatchewan and New Brunswick. Of course, on New Year's Day, Andrew Scheer is in a giant tiger talking about how Justin Trudeau is going to increase the carbon tax after it passes with no evidence, yet at the same time not announcing a carbon plan of his own. Again, in a giant tiger where it is filled with merchandise from China, which is very polluting to ship.
Diesel ships, big cargo ships full of Chinese stuff across the Pacific Ocean. It's only a buck, so what the heck?
Right? Not the message I would think to be pro, or that we're like serious about in the environment. But I guess his point is that it's going to cost the price of things to go up, even though, and this was provided by one of the Saskatchewan newspapers, the Regina paper, that for the average household, the carbon tax would be $403 in direct and indirect costs for 2019, but they would get $600 back in federal tax credits, and that starts actually this tax period. So if you file your taxes tomorrow, you will get that tax credit as part of your rebate.
You're making money. Well, not exactly. A little bit.
What I found funny, too, is Dustin Duncan, the environmental minister for Saskatchewan, someone asked him if he would take the tax rebate, and he said he would. So,
yeah, why wouldn't you, right? And Saskatchewan is interesting in this, in that they jacked up the PST. So they're on and on about tax, but they put the PST on things that didn't have PST before. I think one of them was like used cars off the top of my head. It's like things that weren't taxed before. So Scott Moe is one to talk. He's the one that looks like Hank Hill, by the way, in the Resistance picture. And I think was replaced by Hank Hill in all of the parodies that we saw of that. So if you're wondering who Scott Moe is, because not somebody we talk about often.
No.
Yeah. So, this is all over the place. It's going to be a massive, it's going to be very high in the election issue list. Mostly because the Resistance are going to make it into an election issue. They already have. Because it's all that Andrew Scheer talks about. It's all that I'm talking about. And, of course, the yellow vests. It's on there. Let's call them the Canadian yellow vests to differentiate them from the French yellow vests.
I'm going to say the gilets for the French ones.
The Canadian yellow vests are a bit of a different world because they're pro-pipeline. They're fed up, but, they're saying, well, there's no alternative fossil fuels. We have to use them. And
some slight racism.
Slight? Oh, it's more than slight. Some of the comments like it's the foreign-funded eco-shaming radicals, and just go from there. And of course, I think we talked about it before, how there's always somebody shows up at these rallies with the hoodie with a noose for Trudeau.
The Pfizers.
Yeah, it's just it's Canada first, right? Which is I've also heard a couple of times.
Cool.
So it's not exactly
make Trudeau a drama teacher again.
Yeah, they're against, and they're also against the UN Migration Pact. So the, you know, this is like a.
It's a potpourri of
ultimate,
stupid.
Yeah, potpourri. I was going to call it a mixed message, but yeah, it's potpourri. But yeah, high. You know, every one of these protests, you'll see carbon tax, and I, you know, to some degree, they have a point. Of course, they're allowed to protest.
Of course, no one's saying that.
But it's you know, you're allowed to protest, and then the hate people come. Different world, but lots of the fear mongering is I've even seen it in some mainstream papers. All those liberals and the activists and the vegans and the CBC and
National Post has been
National Post is
like the National Post opinion page has been practically orgasming just, carbon tax hate for the last
carbon
week.
Tax, right.
It's. And the thing of it is, too, the UN climate change report from last year talks about putting like $130 per ton. Because, you know, when you say $20 per ton on the car, that sounds a little low. I mean, you don't even have to know a lot about science to say it's like, that sounds low. $20
like
per ton?
$3 for a million liters of water down the road in Puslinch. It's like, yeah. I'll pay $3 for a million liters of water delivered. Sure. Why wouldn't
it
you?
It sounds ridiculously low.
It is.
But, you know, the way the federal government is looking at it, too, is like we're still talking about maybe a top rate for the price of pollution at like $50, which is, you know, again, using your basic math skills, $50 is less than $135. Mm-hmm. So can you imagine
for now?
So can you imagine how these guys and it's underreported, too. But Trudeau's basically using the same numbers that the Harper government used in order to meet the Paris
to meet the aspirational goal from Paris, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, when people talk about Justin Trudeau being this, like, loony lefty, this crazy environmentalist who's going to, like, destroy us all with carbon tax, it's like, well, he's doing a pretty crappy job of it.
Yeah, I mean, these are pure neoliberal solutions. It's like, well, let's create a market for this. It's, I don't want to be Dr. Doom here, but it's really, it's not going to fix, it's, put it this way. It's not going to fix anything, right? We really need – I'm going to get on the pulpit here a little bit, but if we don't have the wholesale changes, none of this is going to matter, right? So, I mean, they'll always point to Canada in the scheme of things. I was doing a bit of the statistical research on this, and of course you go to the pie chart, and it's like they make Canada out to be this very small contributor, something like pie. One Canada contributing in terms of greenhouse gas, et cetera, is something like 1.6 on the scale of the globe. A country like Indonesia is 1.9% of the total contribution, but we're 37 million people. So a place like Indonesia is 260. It's like 10 times greater. Mm-hmm. So when they say we're the largest contributors per capita, it's absolutely true. Cold country and all that, fair enough. But, you know, putting an incentive on companies, you know, we're going to tax you and this will incentivize you to fix it. I'm not hearing that argument. I'm just hearing it's our tax. We got to get rid of it. And as you say, there's no Scheer and company have no fix for this. They're just going to be like, well, we'll come up with our own solution, kind of like Ontario did. Well, we're just going to do this. And everybody's like, what was that? We don't know. What will that do? It's not going to do anything.
Well, part of the problem is Trudeau and a lot of sort of center left people want you to think that changing the economy wholesale. It's going to be like easy, that it's an easy fix. Yeah, it may cost a little bit of pain, but what, you know, when you're talking to environmentalists and people who know, there's like saying, no, the entire of society has to change in 12 years. If we not even to stop it, just to slow it down so that we have time to address it. And so that we don't make the earth completely unlivable. So, you know, you can talk about Trudeau being a loony lefty all you want. It just isn't the case. Meanwhile, you have...
He's not at all.
The Canadian Chamber of Commerce saying, you know what? A carbon tax is the way to deal with this because all the costs are right there. You see them in black and white. There was a Globe and Mail op-ed, which I found surprisingly even-handed, where they're talking about, you know, we're talking about saving the environment. It's going to be an expensive endeavor. And so do you want to have a carbon tax? And this was the actual title of the article. It's like, do you want to have a carbon tax or do you want to be lied to? Because with a carbon tax, you see it there. Again, you see the numbers in black and white. This is what it costs versus something like the Ford plan, which is saying over 5 years, they're going to put aside $400 million and it's going to be there for companies if, you know, they want to invest in clean energy or whatever. And again, it's borrowing from a plan that hasn't worked in Australia. So it really is a matter of, you know, do we want to be treated like adults and, you know, deal with the pain in order to address a problem that, you know, even a lot of people on the right say that it's a problem. It's you know, you do have the Doug Fords of the world who want to stick their head in the sand or want to ignore the problem. Fair enough. But there are a lot of people who are center-right who recognize there's a problem and maybe we have different ideas on how to deal with it. And then you have people like the Toronto Sun who are like, what's next? A meat tax? They want to do it. They want to do it. They'll put a meat tax on it. It's like, you know what?
Because cow farts are causing, yeah.
Consider, well,
no, I know what you mean.
It's not exactly a ludicrous idea, but you know, how about just saying like maybe eat less meat? Because the flip side of it is too, and this comes from researchers at this university, it's kind of impractical to expect 9 billion people to eat vegan. There just isn't enough
you need to find
capability on this planet for 9 billion people to be vegan. It's just it's impractical.
Well, no, that's not dietary healthy, but that's just me.
Vegans are some of the most unhealthiest people I know.
Yep.
They're always disrespect. It's your choice.
If you want to counter that,
I appreciate your morality. But you know what? If you're like carrying around three different bottles of vitamins with you, it's...
Yeah, where do they come from? I don't know. We'll leave the vegans alone.
We'll leave the vegans alone.
But this is the thing. If they really, really wanted to legislate wholesale changes, they could. Example, Ontario. Mm-hmm. There's no more coal generation in Ontario, right? It's just gone. They said, this is one of the dirtiest things we have. We're going to get rid of it. We're going to do this. Now, mind you, some of it was natural gas, the crack cocaine of fuels, but there's peaker plants. They had a plan to say, yeah, we're going to get rid of coal because it's...
Notice how we haven't had any bad air days lately?
Yeah. Well, I grew up beside a Lakeview coal plant. It's like, you know, I have no idea. Who knows what my lungs are like? But that's, seriously, like you notice these things and it's like, wow, that's gone now. The orange haze of the 80s when they finally said, well, look, we have to change it up or, you know, nothing will happen. So, like I said, if they can make wholesale changes if they would. The same was the Montreal Protocol, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, the ozone's going to be gone, and if it's gone, we're done. Well, let's do this.
Right.
Improvements were made, and things got better. It's not perfect. There's still problems there. There's still people doing things off the grid that are punching holes in it, but at least, you know, it can be done. Will it be done? Is the will there? I don't think it is. And it is in lots of... for lots of people in lots of places, but if you've got the powers that be, like the four provinces you talked about, and I mean, if we do see a conservative government in the fall, it's like, man,
I think that's unlikely. But we'll answer some of these questions next week because we'll leave it on a cliffhanger. We're gonna take a break and then we're gonna come back with some electoral reform talk. You're listening to Open Source as Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Within me, whole life navigating the skin. There ain't a lot that can faze me. Nowadays, I feel wavy like I'm walking on water. I wasn't trained in the Navy, but we fight for these waters because these waters they save me. All water is holy water. I bathe in it daily. Now, can you tell me what the water's worth or how the water works beyond your thirst for it? Your reflection on the surface, the direction of the currents, what they show, a person and a purpose below. Who you are, which way you should go. That's all anyone want to know. That was Shad from his new album. Oh, yeah, Shad.
Shad, remember Shad, host of Q?
I remember Shad from before that.
Yes. A short story about...
Whatever.
Shad, who's... A Short Story About War is the album. New into the station, well, 2018, so fairly new. And that song was called, surprise, The Fool Part 2, or subtitled Water. Any album with a political whiff, we will play on the show. So that's it. I gave the whole thing a spin. It sounded pretty good. So check him out. He's on Secret City Records.
Secret City Records.
What's a record, Dad? I don't know.
Kids, ask your grandparents about a record.
Drop the needle.
Maybe your great-grandparents.
Ask Scotty Hertz what a record is.
Brian Munn about records. Speaking of things that aren't popular. No, so we talked about this before, that BC was having its electoral reform referendum. The results came back like pretty much the day before we went to break, and it was not good news. 1.44 million out of 3.3 million eligible voters cast ballots. Only, oh shoot, where was the number? Anyway.
41?
Yeah. So yeah, only 41% of people, 42.6% of people, but 61.2% voted to keep first past the post. Not the result that Fair Vote Canada wanted, not the result a lot of electoral reform advocates across the country wanted. They thought it was going to finally break through in BC and spread across the country, but nope.
And this is the third time they've had an electoral reform vote in BC. And it sounds like it's done. What was the comment from the deputy premier? It was something like, this is finished. She's pretty much saying that it's never ever going to happen. And I mean, never say never. I mean, but, you know, three times is pretty much it. I think, is it? Yeah, PEI for their provincial election this year in the fall are going to
Be the fall. They might move it up to spring like they did in 2015.
Oh, right. But yeah, it's slated for October, like all of them with fixed election dates. But like you say, it could move. It has to be held on or before that date, I guess. They're going to hold it in their PR referendum with the election as well. So they'll probably get, in terms of turnout, let's call it, a better number than this. Because, and there was some other things that happened too. Whether it really affected this result or not was the postal strike happened. So, of course, they had to extend the voting period just to make sure that the ballots that they figured were going to come in would come in. But of course, it's almost as if the number is, it's not higher, but it's weird because the 2005 referendum, it was 64% said no. In 2016, 55% voted for MMP.
I think you got that backwards.
Have I got backwards? That backwards? Anyway, one of them
was 57% voted for single transferable vote in 2005. And if you're thinking to yourself, wasn't that a majority? It was they needed a supermajority for it to be binding. 60%.
Yeah.
They didn't need 2/3, but 60%. So it was like 3 points shy. And then the second referendum was 39.09% voted to go to single transferable vote. So it's like the percentage of people voting for this is going down.
And that was in 2016, not that long ago. But I think this was a condition of the agreement with the Greens, right? The confidence and supply agreement that they would do this. NDP and the Greens went all in for it, right? They were like, we are for this.
Well, Horgan was like campaigning for it. And the debate over PR versus FPTP was Horgan for PR and
the Liberals.
The Liberal leader, Wilkinson, I think.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Weaver? Wilkinson? Weaver?
No, Weaver's the Greens, right?
Yes. So it must be Wilkinson. First past the post or the status quo.
I saw a bunch of Fraser Institute articles that were against it, but of course they're all written by the same person.
Yeah.
It's like the Hertz Institute writes whatever. No, but I mean, I might just start that. I don't know. It sounds like the polling that happened, this kind of thing is split along generational lines, and that the younger folk, the youngins, the millennials, get it and want it and aren't worried about, well, it's too complicated. And
they also won't go out and vote for it after.
Yes, of course. There's an app. Vote BC. And then is there an app? Can I vote with an app? Sorry, millennials. I mean, make fun of you. First the vegans, then the millennials. Course, the rest who are over the line are like, no, we must have this whole established system. And interestingly, some of the arguments for yes and no were similar in some ways, because it's like, well, if you vote yes, then the extremists like Trump and Doug Ford types are going to win. And if you vote no, or if you vote for proportional representation, then the extremists are going to win because the Nazis are going to get a seat. It's like the argument is always like, oh, these extremists are going to get in. They're getting in.
It's an extremely poor argument because the extremists are getting in, whether you sort of let them in by starting a smaller party or starting a new
with
party,
one big seat,
or whether they absorb a bigger party and then get in that way, but yeah. by people who are just going to vote party line no matter what. I mean, it's happening.
Yeah, it's not as if places...
That's an extremely poor argument to build from.
But that's how the arguments were going, and there was the commercial with, like, jackbooted people marching, saying, you need to vote against this so the Nazis are going to come. But, you know, countries that have systems like this, for example, Denmark, little Denmark, they managed to get by. You know, it's like they do have some people that probably have extreme views in their parliament. For more on that, watch Borgen, my favorite show of all time. But which goes on and on about the agreements that need to be made and people can get along and whatever. But there seems to be a bit of, shall we call it fear? Is it changing the grand old system that we have?
It's definitely not going to happen through referendum. I think, PEI is going to have one. I don't think it's going to change.
We're done in PI either. No.
Yeah.
Probably not.
I don't think anybody's going to vote for in favor there in any large numbers. What's going to be interesting to watch happen is, because right now the Greens and PEI are running neck and neck with the Liberals. Now, if the Greens should happen to form a government, they do the referendum thing or will they just impose it? Because the NDP talk a big game about how we were for electoral reform first. But I don't know any NDP government in the country that has pushed ahead with it, except for maybe outside of doing
Alberta
referendums.
And, well, we had one.
Alberta
Ontario
hasn't.
Too,
yeah, Alberta changed, hasn't. Right. Manitoba hasn't.
No, they're not gung-ho for it.
No. So, you know, will the Greens in PEI go that way? I don't know.
If they win, that would be very interesting if they did. And I have heard that. There's been a couple polls saying that, you know what, everybody's tired of...
Same old.
Yeah, and it would be interesting if the smallest province makes the biggest. You know, well, we've obviously had our agreement.
Also, where Confederation started.
Exactly. So it could be it could be the place for it to happen. And then, you know, maybe that. Well, all speculative stuff, really.
Speculative. I am going to have to bail. There's a city council meeting starting in 19
so
minutes.
I'm going to talk to myself for 4 minutes.
No, Scotty's going to play his interview that he did with John Smith. John is the son of Harry Leslie Smith, the so-called world's oldest rebel, who passed away, sadly, back at the end of November. And John Smith was here in Guelph last week talking to rebels young and old here, and Scotty got a chance. Well, soldiers, rebel Scotty Hertz got a chance to sit down with John Smith the night before his appearance at Breezy Corners, and we're going to play that clip.
With John Smith, John's an activist who's currently on a tour both in memory of and to continue the legacy of his father, author, World War II veteran, activist, and known as the world's oldest rebel, Harry Leslie Smith, who passed away in November at the age of 95. First, John, let me pass on my personal condolences. I followed your father regularly and, of course, yourself when you took over his Twitter account when he wasn't able to tweet any longer.
Thank you so much.
I know the hospital can be a lonely place both for patients and caregivers alike, yet I get the feeling that you didn't feel alone on that journey in the slightest, that you thousands of people
no,
had
No,
your
I didn't.
Back.
And my father and I had discussed this because he knew that his health was failing over the last year. And I asked him, I said, what do you want me to do when you become incapacitated and can no longer tweet? And he said, I want you to take over for me and talk about what's going on with me. And so I did that. And you're right. I did not feel there was a great community sense while he was dying. In fact, I said to somebody, I said, in a strange way, it was like when Tolstoy was dying of pneumonia. And the world sort of held its breath, and there were reports coming out about his health in 1908 when he died. And it had that same sort of ethos.
And that's the thing, now everything is so accelerated. It was all very, all very instant. And I noticed there was condolences from the highest levels, including I happened to see a bit of Westminster, and there was Jeremy Corbyn, who obviously
that's correct.
Your father knew or met.
In many ways, they were friends and comrades, and they got to know each other quite well over the last 3 years because my father was one of the first supporters of Jeremy Corbyn.
And then Theresa May sent her condolences. I'm sure your dad would have found that pretty funny.
I thought I thought that was interesting because I said, I don't think my dad would have, I think my dad would have taken it in good grace, but said, you know, he would have preferred her to end austerity, make a proper Brexit if there is one, and probably also get out of selling arms to Saudi Arabia.
One of your father's areas of advocacy was for socialized medicine, both here in Canada and the UK. And I have to ask, since you ended up in that exact spot where so many of us find ourselves, someone in the family needing maximum care and all the things that go with that. Is the system working?
No, the system's not working at all. I mean, when we took my father to the hospital, when I took my father to the hospital, think about it. He was sort of a VIP. He had a social media platform of Twitter, which had 250,000 followers. And yet, he was stuck in emergency for 36 hours because there was no ICU bed.
This hallway medicine, essentially.
More or less hallway medicine. Mm-hmm. And we can the culprits are not just Ford. The culprits are also the previous Liberal government. Because there was austerity and cutbacks to healthcare, and this is what we see. And through it all, through a lot of his hospital stays over the last year, I could see a decline in services. And I could see a decline in services for not only him, but other patients. And that is telling that in a country as rich as Canada, that people are not getting the fact that if we're not going to pay for our health care, it's going to be privatized, and then only the very few are going to be able to afford the best possible health care.
Now, Harry was a bit of an unlikely phenomenon that most people that become massive on social media aren't in their 80s or their 90s and, you know, don't go on to write five books at that age. So when your dad finally opened up, I guess, to the world, let's say, were you surprised at how famous he became?
No, I knew when we started this project, this last stand of his, that I told him that you are unique in the fact that you are the last voice of your generation, and you are unique because you come from the working class. You are not a professional, you're not an economist, you're not a politician, you weren't somebody that became rich and famous, you were just the ordinary Joe. And you're an ordinary Joe with a very poetic heart and a deep memory and a good historical knowledge and a good political knowledge. So that will resonate with people. And it did.
Yeah, because I'm happy if I get retweeted like a half dozen times about Harry in the year of like 250,000 people just like that. And now you, I guess there's quite a bit of responsibility.
Well, there is. And I'm very humble by the fact that so many people have stuck with his Twitter feed, considering that I took it over. Mm-hmm. And I'm also aware of the responsibilities of not only maintaining my father's legacy, but also developing the path that it should take since he's died. And so that, you know, it's a series of trial and errors, but I think that I've struck the right note so far.
And Harry was quite the champ at batting down the trolls, and then that would get retweeted and so on. What were his feelings on the... What were his feelings on the alt-right? I guess he just saw the same old thing.
He had sheer disgust for the right, and he knew that it was a sham and a complete confidence game against poor people, as it always has been. It disgusted him because he didn't understand how people could fall for it a second time. He didn't understand how people could say, you know what, my generation was the one that helped build whether it was a better Canada or a better Britain. And they had made fundamental problems in a lot of ways, but they did build a much better country. And then to see this fall down because people are just too lazy to learn their history, or that they're easily manipulated because they have no historical knowledge, it just infuriated him. What upset him the most was that most people he thought should just have the common sense to know, if you don't have money, don't believe the guy that's richer than you telling you that it's the person poorer than you that's taking your money.
The first time I recall hearing about your dad was when he said he was giving up wearing the poppy on Remembrance Day. I think it was in The Guardian.
Yeah.
As it had become, I think, too political in his eyes. Was that kind of the point where he started to evolve into being a full-on activist? Or I guess maybe it wasn't any one thing.
I think it began a little bit before the poppy because he wrote another piece called Is Cameron's Britain What We Fought the War For? Because he was absolutely outraged. And this was, again, just on the cusp of the beginning of the anniversary of the First World War. And he could see that this was all being propagandized and that how the First World War was being used to politicize, again, wars that are being fought today or current opinions, without realizing that that war was a complete and utter sham and a complete and utter bloodbath for the working class. So that's when he became a full-blown activist. The Poppy Essay solidified that. And the Poppy Essay is very important because it does say that you can be a patriot. That doesn't mean that you have to wear a poppy to designate your love of country or your belief that those in the armed forces should be properly taken care of. In fact, what he said is that this is an absolute joke, because the thing is that you're actually giving it to a private organization money that then is used to help former soldiers. And his point was, why isn't the state paying for all of this? Why do we need a private charity to help soldiers that are down on their luck or have developed PTSD and this sort of thing? This should be the price that governments pay if they're going to send young men and women off to war.
And of course, within this period too, he wrote five books total?
Five books in 7 years.
That in itself is incredible. But as he said, his character was forged out of two big events, the Depression and World War II. There must have been moments, though, I guess, in this, you know, in his later years, where it all seemed a bit unreal, not only having lived through all of that, but did he ever sort of take a step back and say, I can't believe this is happening
today?
Well,
no, he disassociated himself from a lot of social media, in the sense of that he sort of saw it. What always used to freak him out was if we were at a train station or even in Metro, and somebody would come up to him and go, are you Harry Leslie Smith? And he would go, yes. And I go, and they would go, I follow your Twitter feed, or I saw you on the news, and I think you're a fantastic man. He would be totally chuffed by this, but it would stagger him, because he goes, why are all of these people following me? Because these are just common sense rules about how to live a decent life and make sure that your society is actually for the many and not the few.
And considering he was born in a world before television and radio was kind of new, then all of a sudden it's like,
exactly,
everybody knows this.
And it's one of those things. Now, I mean, what was always brilliant about him was, in the 1980s, when he was still working, he introduced computers into his company to do inventory and that sort of thing. Because he
was an innovator back then.
Yeah, he knew that this was the trend for the future. And it was one of those things that he always wanted to stay on top of new technology. Now, having said that, he could never work a television clicker in his life, right? That he would never understand that. But the fundamentals of social media he understood brilliantly and intuitively. But as he always said, he was a wireless op during the Second World War. And he said, until the age of 18, I'd never used a telephone. Right. And he said, then they're making me use what is modern technology. And he said, you get a handle on it, because that's what people do. They adapt and learn.
I also understand he had a massive following among young people. And I get the impression somehow that there didn't really seem to be a generation gap with
No.
your dad. And it's almost like he bypassed
No, he identified,
the boomers and the Gen X people like myself. And then it's just like the young people speaks to them somehow.
He identified with millennials much more than anybody else, because he knew that they were a generation that was being screwed over in so many ways, and that he saw them, and he told them this, that you will be the greatest generation of the 21st century because you have to fix all of the problems that we've left you, or otherwise this planet is doomed. So he had a great deal of empathy for the millennials, and he wanted them to know that they were not alone, that they had a hard road to progress on, but that they could do it because his generation did it. He had no hope for the boomers.
Because what was his line? Don't let my past be your
future.
Yeah.
That's right.
More recently, in the area of Harry's advocacy that you're hoping to continue on with, is regarding the plight of refugees, fleeing war,
right,
economic hardship. Can you talk about the trip you took with your dad to the Calais jungle? What did you see there?
Well, what we saw there, and it's a horrendous place. It really is one of the most frightening places I've ever encountered, because it is probably, I think it was about 10 square kilometers of despair, where people are living in disheveled tents and in wooden squats and this sort of thing, and they're all of the refugees that have washed up from Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and every other place that is in a warlike condition or in an economically deprived condition. And these people were very desperate to just get a better life, and most of them wanted to go to the UK because they had either familial connections there or because of their greater knowledge of the English language, and also their belief that they would get a fairer shake there than in France, because there is also a great deal of prejudicism and racism against refugees. But I tell you, when we were there, what was encouraging was that these refugees there would come up to my father, and my father would be able to tell them, you know, I saw a similar refugee crisis in 1945, and I saw the same types of faces like yours. And I know that humanity will get its act together, and you people will find a home, and you will be able to build a better life. And he was determined to see that happen. And it was absolutely horrendous. Like I said, the living conditions they were forced to live under. The gendarmes there were brutal and ruthless against them. And if anybody thinks that somebody would choose being a refugee because their life is somewhat difficult, is just completely ignorant. Because the only reason why people become refugees are because their lives are in danger, they're in war situations, they're threatened sexually, they're threatened economically to a point that they know that they will die if they do not leave. And people just have to understand that the only thing that separates us and being a refugee is the luck of the draw.
In continuing on with the advocacy, you're planning, you've come up to Guelph, but you're planning a bit of a tour later this year? Or?
Well, I'm continuing on his last stand, which was his refugee tour. So that I will be traveling in the next couple of days through the United States and then into Tijuana to report on the migrant caravans there in Mexico. And put it from the perspective of the way Harry would see it and the way I would see it, also live tweeting it, and then traveling into Texas to observe the children's concentration camps that ICE has built there. From there, in February, I'm traveling back to Europe and into Greece and Italy to visit the refugee camps there. Throughout the year, I will be traveling into Turkey and hopefully also into North Africa to visit refugee camps there and also continuously report on that. But also I want to finish, there's two other projects that I need to finish. One, my father had partially written his book on the refugee crisis, and I want to complete that for him. And also I want to finish a book on my odyssey, my political and familial odyssey with my father over the last 10 years.
Have I got to write, there's a memorial service coming up for your father?
Yes. On the 31st in Toronto, there's a public memorial put on by the Broadbent Institute. And anybody can just Google it, and then they can RSVP for it. But it will be a night of words and music, and it should be a great night. And hopefully at the end, everybody can go off to a pub and raise a glass to them.
So if people want to find out more about your work and what you're up to, how can they do that?
I would say that just go on Twitter to @HarrysLastStand and follow us, and you will be able to see everything there.
Thanks very much for joining me today, John. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me on.
I'm speaking with John Smith. John's an activist.
John Smith, son of Harry Leslie Smith, on a tour which actually kicked off in Guelph. He said that after his father died, his stop in Guelph was his first stop after everything that had happened. So I guess a good place to start any world tour, I suppose. As some citizens of town know, you've been listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook. I now have a Podbean. I'm Podbean as well. Podbean or spannerbook.podbean.com. And I still blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com. Find Adam through all the regular channels, Guelph Politico. He'll be tweeting the meeting tonight. Find him on Twitter at Adam Donaldson. There'll be lots going on. And in Guelph Politico as well. See, because he's not here, we can't bounce the thing off each other like we do. So anyway, thanks for listening. And stay tuned for Sounds Good to Me coming up at the top of the hour. Thanks for joining us once again. And we'll speak to you soon. Of course we will. We'll be here next week as we are every week. No break for us, right? So anyway, take care, folks, and we will talk to you soon. Bye.